Macabre misfortune.
I'm watching you.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 73 of Macabre Misfortunes. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Tracy.
Tracy, today's episode is going to be a little bit different. It's a different kind of story than we typically do, but it's all going to tie in.
Okay.
It's also a little bit of a shorter story than we typically do, but we have an addition to today's.
Oh, well, let's hear about it.
Well, we've got Sarah DeDonatis, who is actually up in Michigan, and she's helped us set up our birthday show that we got going on. She's the one that actually scouted out the location and all that. So if you don't like it, blame her. But the long and short of it is we're going to start doing I don't know how regular it is of a segment with her where she's telling us some stories and some stuff she's researched. And kind of like we did with Fear of the Week with Leslie back when, we were doing that. So we'll start doing that ever so often. I don't exactly know where we're going to put it. It's probably going to be maybe a Sunday night thing like we did with Leslie or midweek. I'm not sure, but I thought the very first one we would put out now.
Okay.
Why not? And in this, when we get into it, we talk about the story, but then at the end, we actually talk a little bit about Detroit, some stuff that's going on, like a car show and stuff that's going on during the time that we're going to be up there. So if you're coming up for the Detroit show, there might be a couple of things you could do. She talks about the Presque Isle Lighthouse, which we did a story on about 3 years ago. That's like right in the area
of
where we're going. So there's we talk about safety in Detroit and the stigma and all that stuff, and she starts talking about all the great things that you can do in downtown Detroit and how safe that she thinks it is as being a woman that goes and does a lot of stuff by herself downtown.
Yeah.
So it's a really good listen. So I thought it'd be a fun to probably just tag it onto this one since that show's just a couple weeks away.
Sounds great. Thanks for all that info, Sarah.
Yes. So, Tracy, like I said, this is going to be a different kind of story. I think you're going to see, though, it fits. And if you stick with it, I think you're going to find this to be a pretty cool story. By the start of the Civil War in 1861, Daniel S. Butterfield was a very successful New York City lawyer. He was also a pretty successful financier. He had been a member of the New York militia since 1854, and he soon found himself going into action as a colonel of the 12th New York. He was leading troops across the Long Bridge from Washington, D.C. into Virginia.
Oh, bigger. I mean, he's just like a big-time, big shot, I
guess. Yeah, I mean, and he went from just being a very rich civilian to... Hey, I'm in the military, and
it just seems so weird that there was. I know this is stupid that there were lawyers back in that day. I just think it's so weird.
I mean, there've been lawyers for 300, 400 years before that. Okay,
doesn't take much for me.
Butterfield became a brigadier general and then a major general.
Wait, I think it's brigadier, isn't it?
What did I say?
Brigadier. You did.
Well, I meant to say brigadier. If I did say brigadier, then that was a mistake. But I meant to say a brigadier general. And then he was a major general. And he eventually served as chief of the staff for General Joseph Hooker and George Meade.
Well, good for him. Well, he's a go-getter, isn't he?
Butterfield would be awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his actions at the Battle of Gaines' Mill in Virginia on June 27, 1862, which I think today is the highest award that you can actually receive.
Dang.
But his accomplishments on the battlefield are not why we are talking about him today. He was a very creative individual. He was the originator of the shoulder patch and the badge. So when you see...
I thought he was going to say a shoulder pad. What the girls have in their shirts.
No, but you know, when you see the military and they've got the those little stripes things, and all this, he created that.
Wow.
He designed them to identify the soldiers of his particular unit, which is now used by militaries all over the world.
They look really nice, too, I think.
Again, still not the reason that we're going to talk about him today.
Look, there's so many hours in the day. Dude, did he ever sleep?
Butterfield also had an ear for music.
Of course he did.
He had no musical training, but was pretty good with just correcting things, sounding off. And he was pretty damn good with a trumpet, even though he had no professional training. So he would do variations of some of the regular military trumpet calls that would take place during the day or at night. And of course, that was a big deal back in the day. The trumpet mm-hmm. calls was how you gathered your troops. So each troop pretty much had their own set of calls mm-hmm. so they could identify them from others.
That's amazing.
Later, he would do some original compositions. He did this because in the heat of battle, he often found that his brigade responded to other brigade calls and vice versa. So the other different people out there were getting their calls mixed up with the other troops.
Oh.
One night in July 1862, he was with General George McClellan's army at Harrison Landing in Virginia. Now, Butterfield was in the company of Brigadier General Daniel Sickles and several other officers. The landing is actually the site of Berkeley Plantation, and there was more than 100,000 soldiers camped out for about 45 days in the summer of 1862. That's where they were at.
100,000.
So at the end of the day, the bugler played the final call of the day, which was a song called Extinguish the Lights. Butterfield didn't like it at all. He said he didn't like the sound of the call. He felt that it was too formal and it was more like a trumpet welcoming a foreign leader, like a queen or a king, more than a soldier's goodnight.
Okay.
The following morning, after mail call, Butterfield actually scribbled some musical notes down on the back of an envelope. It was a revision of the old French bugle call. Mm-hmm. He then summoned the brigadier bugler, a private by the name of Oliver W. Northern of the 83rd Pennsylvania Infantry. Now, Butterfield handed him the notes on the back of the envelope, and he asked him to blow the notes. And he said, "I don't blow anything for less than $20. Not quite satisfied with the first attempt, Butterfield made a couple of minor corrections, and then he asked him to give it another try. He then changed a note or two, and in the composition, when it was all said and done, had 24 notes, and that was that. After the bugler kind of practiced on this for about 2 days, he had been asked to go ahead and play it at the end of the day for the brigade. The song's title was called Lights Out.
Okay.
Well.
That sounds better.
A short time later, the song would be played at a military funeral. Now, the service was for a Union cannon worker out in the field. Mm-hmm. He had been killed in battle. His name was Captain Jordan Tidball. His commanding officer chose to honor the man with Butterfield's call instead of the customary 3 rifle shots. And he chose this because he didn't want the nearby enemy to actually interpret the gunfire as the beginning of an attack.
So
he said, "Well, we'll play this instead." No other piece of unpublished music in history has ever spread as rapid as this song. Within a matter of weeks, it was adopted by all Union armies. And then, within a matter of a month or two, it became the official in all Confederate camps as well.
Wow.
So now this song is being played by all of the military across the country. Even though they had major political differences between the Confederate and the Union soldiers, they all agreed on this universal song because they felt that it was just a beautiful song to end the day. This song is still used and can be heard at almost every military funeral in the U.S. The bugle call, Lights Out, has become known by another name over the years. The name of the bugle call today, Taps.
That's amazing. What an honor that is, you know?
I thought that was a pretty cool story because I didn't really know the background of Taps. I know Taps, and almost everybody knows the song.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that it was just something. So the guy who created Taps that gets played at almost every military funeral and at the end of most, I would say probably every, I don't know if it's just the Army or if it's all military, but the fact that it gets played for almost every military funeral and it gets played at the end of the day, I mean, it comes from the same guy who created the patches, and I mean, this guy was something else.
Yeah, he sure was. Very gifted, very knowledgeable, and sounds like a pretty awesome dude. I'd like to meet him, but not now, so.
Good luck with that.
That was a good story.
Anyway, for those of you who aren't familiar with Taps, I'll find it and I'll put it on here. Just a little snippet of it. So probably as soon as you hear it, you'll know it. Even if you're in another country, you'll probably recognize it from movies or something else.
And he's saying taps, not bats.
Taps.
Not baps.
Taps.
Get it?
Yeah. So anyways, that's that story. So let's take a quick listen to Taps, a couple seconds of it, just so you know what it is. And then we'll bring on Sarah.
Yeah.
All right, Tracy, the song's like a minute long, so I went ahead and just played the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple things that I wanted to touch on that we really didn't. First of all, I did verify it is played at every military institution in the United States.
Well, that's amazing. That's awesome. It's beautiful. It's beautiful and sad at the same time.
Yes. And then the other thing I wanted to touch on is why it's called Taps. And there's a lot of different stories about this. There is no guaranteed this is why it's called that, but a lot of people seem to think that when they can't use a bugle or they don't use a bugle, there's three taps to a drum, so it's like pop, 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 and they think that that might be why it's called Taps.
Oh,
because it's three drum hits if they don't use a bugle. So
that kind of makes sense.
I don't know if that's accurate or not, but that is one of the major stories out there. But there are a bunch of different stories on how I got it. But
that's interesting.
Anyways, let's listen to Sarah. Hey, guys. I have a special guest here because we're going to try something out with you guys. You guys get to be guinea pigs. We're going to try a new segment. And you know, in the past, we've done this. It's usually worked out really well. If you remember Fear of the Week with Leslie Fear, who now has her own podcast, Because I Want to Know. It all started with her doing Fear of the Week here on this show. So we're going to do this time with our own Michigan native, Sarah D. Donatus. Sarah, first of all, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Jerry. Happy to be here.
So what did we decide this segment was going to be called?
I think we had it down as Sasquatch Suspicion and Spirits with Sarah.
There we go. There we go. That sounds good. So I love a good alliteration. Sarah, you've got, you've done some podcasts in the past. You were doing some stuff with Tim Mullins. We all know Tim Mullins around here.
Yep.
And you've done stuff for our Halloween episode. For at least the last 2 years, I think maybe 3 years running.
3 years now. And then James Barnes as well, his show.
His Christmas special. Show.
Mm-hmm.
This is not anything new for you. And, you know, you came on our show years ago, and I know it's been at least 3 years, probably 4 years ago, and told us about the haunted restaurant up in Detroit. I remember that.
Yes.
And that was fun. So you're not a stranger to this show by any means. Like I said, you've done the Halloween stuff. So we've been kind of putting together, you have a lot of stories that, you know, superstition, folklore, and even other stuff like the Edmund Fitzgerald and stuff like that. That's in your neck of the woods up there. So yeah. When you come on, it's pretty much going to be an all Michigan segment. Is that fair to say?
For the most part, I have some Southern stories that are trickled in there as well.
Okay. I'm okay with that. As long as they come with fried chicken, we're good with that.
Oh, always. And grits.
Oh, I don't. You can keep the grits. I'm a Southerner that does not like grits.
Aye.
Okay, Sarah. So what's the first story that you're going to share with us tonight?
Well, this story is about Windermere Park Lighthouse in Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Okay, cool. So yeah. I'm assuming that there's some hauntings going on there.
Well, it's more folklore. And there's a visitor, a certain visitor that comes from the deep depths of, you know, the hottest place on the planet.
I'm going to shut up and I'm going to let you tell us the story.
All right. Will do. Thank you, Jerry. Hello, everybody. Today, I'm bringing you to a location where a lake funnels into a river and where the power of the water awakens the senses. This beautiful yet hidden location has a lot of history and gripping story of folklore. How I found this little story? It's one of those things. I will sometimes be bored at night and just kind of flitter around through Google Earth and go along waterways or go along roads and try to find interesting places. And one evening, I landed on a lighthouse that I didn't know existed. And the next day, my husband and I were there. That's how I roll. Other than cemeteries, lighthouses are my jam. I enjoy them because they're standing testimonies to history, maritime lore, and saving lives. One thing that struck me when I visited this site, watching the sun glisten on the tail end of Lake St. Clair as it flowed into the mouth of the Detroit River, was the power and swiftness of the current. For those not familiar, Lake St. Clair on Michigan's southeast coast is very shallow, 19 feet at her natural depth. They actually have to dredge the shipping channel through her center to 27 feet deep to allow for freighters to pass safely between the lakes. The freighters are actually long flat ships that carry goods back and forth. All of the water from the lakes Superior, Huron, they both flow through St. Clair River, which is north of our lake, and then filters through Lake St. Clair, which then pushes into the Detroit River. The water is so powerful flowing through Lake St. Clair that all of the water is exchanged in this lake every 7 to 14 days. So the lake at the end of my street is completely changed over every 1 to 2 weeks.
Wait a minute. This lighthouse can't be that far from you then.
No, it's not.
And you had no clue it existed.
No, not at all. I was skimming the edge of Lake St. Clair and got to the mouth of the Detroit River and it said Windermere Lighthouse. I'm like, well, what the heck is that? So then I, you know, opened it up and then I went down the rabbit hole of research and landed on all of this wonderful history.
Awesome. Okay, continue on.
Yes. All of the water then gets compressed from Lake St. Clair into the Detroit River. That river ferries the water into Lake Erie. So just to kind of give you an idea, it runs down the thumb of the state of Michigan. The Detroit River is known for being a good place to die if you fall in. Why is that? It's because of the rushing water. There are so many different currents that go in so many different directions that if you fall in, you get dragged underneath. A lot of people pass away on that river, sometimes by choice, sometimes by not. Today's story brings us to the dividing line between Grosse Pointe Park and Detroit. Windmill Point is part of a very large community inside Grosse Pointe. It is a lakeside community where many of the houses are multi-million dollar homes. But of course, as in everything, it all started with humble beginnings. Windmill Point started out as an up north type location where people would go for summer or for vacations. Very quickly, people fell in love with the area and they would stay around. Because the city of Detroit is built in a way that encourages car driving, and does not support mass transit or walking. This area was able to be inhabited because of the close proximity to the big three in the city of Detroit, the big three being Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors. Very wealthy people lived, and in many cases still do live, in Grosse Pointe area. The community of Windmill Point got its name from the isle that we are talking about today. Windmill Point Island was known in the 18th century as Presque Isle, which translates to almost an island in French. It was given this name because the island is surrounded by water on three sides, yet it still has an attachment to land. In the early 18th century, a windmill was put on the highest point in the island because it was very marshy and wet. After building this amazing structure, the island got its nickname. The stone windmill that stood there was around 30 feet in height and stood on the shores of Lake St. Clair. On March 3rd, 1837, Congress appropriated $5,000, or the equivalent of $133,000 in today's money, to build a lighthouse on Windmill Island. In about a year, the lighthouse had been constructed and was operating. The tower at the time was built in stone and was 44 feet tall. In 1874, another, more appropriate lighthouse was built on the island. Throughout the years, the lighthouse went through many updates, as lighthouses do. In 1848, 5 lamps and 14-inch reflectors had been added to the light and were used to produce a fixed white light available at the mouth of the river. Just a little maritime background. Every single buoy and light, whether it be a lighthouse or a lighted buoy, on most inland waterways around the United States and portions of the world are given a sequence of numbers and letters, and some of them are given a sequence of light blinks or light colors. This way, it allows maritime travelers to find their way when they are lost. Once able to see the color and blinking sequence of a light at night or read the numbers by day, the captains can utilize a navigational chart and a directional fixed compass called a compass rose. With the help of a tool called a parallel ruler, they can navigate themselves to safety. Many true captains today still utilize these tools. GPS and radar are not always good during storms in rough lakes. These lakes, these Great Lakes, are so rough that they scare most experienced salty captains from the ocean. But those are for stories for the future. We'll get there one day. In the area behind the lighthouse, a U.S. Marine hospital was opened in 1857. Now, this to me is fascinating. The primary focus of this hospital was to care for the mariners who were traveling through the ports. The concern, and therefore the need for the hospital for these sailors, was the fear of their having illnesses that were foreign to the area. If these illnesses were brought to a main hospital with local citizens, exposure might cause widespread illnesses. The hospital was well known for its beautiful architecture and spectacular lawns, being the topic of many a newspaper article. It also boasted a form of health insurance. According to the historicaldetroit.com site, to keep the hospital running for the sailors, it was built to serve. All sailors were taxed a 20-cent a month fee for possible health needs, like a healthcare premium. This service began in 1843. The hospital dues were doubled to 40 cents a month in 1870. Any crew member on board any registered vessel had the fee deducted from their paychecks and collected by their captains. Any sailor needing medical care for up to a limit of 3 months after falling ill was entitled to free care, room, and board at the hospital. They demolished that hospital building in the 1960s for disrepair, and the city of Detroit received the land and made it into a municipal park. The park is now named Mariner Park. In 1879, Congress paid to have a road constructed, which is called Alter Road, between Jefferson Avenue and the lighthouse. That road is still there today, and in fact, the one I drove down to go visit the park. The standing lighthouse that we have today was built in 1933. And is the only historic structure left on this piece of land. There is a beautiful grass lawn, playground, boardwalk along the waterfront, and plenty of, let me tell you, some huge fish to be caught. I have seen some of these guys. I visited the park a couple times, and one time this guy had, I have to say it was 3 feet tall, the fish, when he pulled it out of the water. It was, wow. Anyway, my husband and I did make the trek about a year ago for research and photographs, which I'll post on the website, on your Facebook page, with your permission. Of course. And not to, And not to mention, to see this beautiful little lighthouse. She's not the most ornate lighthouse out there, but still stands to save lives. So in the beginning, I had mentioned that there's also folklore that surrounds this Presque Isle. Back in 1712, the French wanted Fort Pontchartrain, also known as Fort Detroit. They wanted this really bad. They waited for the English, who inhabited the fort, to become confident in their security to strike. When the main Indian tribes who supported the fort were off hunting, leaving only a small group of soldiers to man the fort, the French made their move. What ensued was nothing short of a slaughter, with many neighboring tribes hearing of the war that was going on, joining in to support one side or the other. This resulted in a bloody war, thick with brutality and death, the vicious and victorious tribe screaming their war cries whilst the dead and dying lay at their feet. Even war-hardened soldiers from France and England looked away from the gruesome sight. Once the dust had settled, over 1,000 people, mainly native tribesmen, were massacred. The tribes brought their dead to Presque Isle and buried them in a mass grave. The legend goes that years after this massacre, a man named Jean and his sister, Josette, moved into the island and built a mill. There were many rumors and problems with the mill being built in that location by the locals because they were building on top of the dead. Jean and Josette seemed unhindered by the location's history and the troubled townsfolk. These siblings pressed on and built a stone mill, which is actually called a grist mill. Stone mills or grist mills are mills that are powered by water and usually built right next to a swift-running water source. These mills had a round stone that was fixed on the floor. It had lines carved into its face that would help grind the grain. On top of that stone was an equally large round stone with carvings on its bottom to ensure even grinding. The top stone would turn with the power of the water and would grind corn into flour for baking and cooking. The stones were probably harvested from the Thumb area in Michigan, one of the pluses to living in the state. They could have easily brought down through the waterways. It would not have been a problem. In fact, there's a city that's Gristmill City, and that's what they do, is that's where all the gristmills came from. Jean was not a very friendly person and would rather stay to himself and not mingle with those in town. You know, the quiet and keeps to himself type. It was rumored that the young ladies in town wanted to meet him, but he was unbothered by such attention. Josette was years older than Jean and was quite a strong woman and very non-traditional. She was intelligent and a shrewd businesswoman. For a woman at this time, it was unheard of to have done everything she accomplished. She had saved her money, made some very good business deals, and was able to own a half of the mill that she and Jean built. So as you can imagine, the relationship between them might have been interesting. Her being a business owner and a woman might not have been accepted. It makes one wonder. Years passed, and Josette fell gravely ill. Jean came to her care as much as he could. While he was caring for her in her greatest hours of need, he would ask her repeatedly if she would sign over her half of the mill to him when she perished. As you can imagine, this did not go over well. She was very upset by the whole thing. He even went as far as to reach out to his family to come and care for her and then pressure her to sign off on her side of the mill to him. One day, she became so enraged and so upset that she told her brother she would never give him her half, that she would rather leave her half to the devil than give it to him. As luck would have it, Josette fully recovered and was able to continue on with her life. Can you imagine the dinner table conversation after that happened?
Right.
Oh, I digress. Josette did not forget the pressures that her brother and family put on her to sign her half of the mill to him. Oddly enough, a few months after she was ill and recovered, she was found dead in her bed. She died suddenly. Well, isn't that odd?
Right.
The same night that she passed away, while her body lay in state for viewing surrounded by candlelight, an amazing storm blew up out of nowhere. Now, typically, these type of storms are nothing new for the Great Lakes because of the power that the lakes hold. This kind of thing does happen all the time. However, oddly enough, the storm blew up right after she died. Through the storm, the winds came and pummeled the mill, surrounded by bright lightning, loud crashes of thunder, and wind. Everybody was fearful because this storm was so powerful. Then, a huge rumbling and crackling sound came out of nowhere, with a backdrop of inky blackness as the storm raged on and the clouds drowned out any remaining light. A huge wave crashed ashore. Then, appearing before the witnesses, a hairy man with horns on his head and a forked tail with fire lapping the tips appeared. With another huge wave, half of the gristmill was gone after being broken in two. People had noticed that there was a pungent smell after the storm, a smell of sulfur and death. They also recorded hearing an evil laugh coming out of the rubble from an unknown source. Rumor has it that when the storm winds blow from the northeasterly direction, which is opposite from what we usually have, and thunder is heard off in the distance, an odd hairy figure with horns on his head and a forked tail that seems to be blazing with fire can be seen walking around the area where the ruins once stood. It is thought that the devil himself is coming back to try to run his half of the grist mill.
Nice.
So that's the story. I will post pictures of the island that I took with your permission, like you said I could. And if you want to learn more on this folklore and the war that started it all, you can check out a book called Legends of Les Detroit by Marie Carolyn Watson Hamlin. What a name, right? Would you like to sign that every time? I also referenced Haunted Michigan, Real Estate Blog, HistoricalDetroit.com, and Lighthouse Friends websites for a lot of my research as well. So I just wanted to give you that. So what did you think?
I liked it. It was interesting. We covered the Prescott Lighthouse back about 3 years ago, but we didn't cover anything I don't think that you talked about. It was more, there was a couple of hauntings inside the lighthouse that we covered and just in general stuff like that. I don't think we covered any of the history of the island or any of that. So it's a perfect little combo if people want to go back and listen. Like I said, that was a long time ago. It was August. It was in August of 2020 when we covered it.
Wow. Okay. Because I did look for hauntings and I came up dry. So that's interesting. I will definitely go back and listen to that one. Yeah.
Well, I am a professional when it comes to fun and haunting. So
you're good. You're very, very good. Yes, you are.
Sometimes it's just a matter of having the right book in some cases.
Yes. Amen. Amen. Yeah, I do have the Legends of Lady Detroit in my wish list now because I want to see what else is out there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I didn't realize that place was that close to you guys. So we'll have to, I'll have to make it a point to maybe drive out there because I'm a lighthouse freak too. And I haven't seen that many in life.
Yes. And there's one up in that I'll probably end up covering. One up in Port Huron that I went up all 94 steps. And then I had to literally crawl down the 94 steps because I don't do well with heights like that. But it's beautiful. And then you can actually see the mouth of the St. Clair River, Lake Huron coming into the St. Clair River. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I know we've covered our fair share of lighthouses on the show because, yeah, I love... I know we covered the Hasita Head Lighthouse. That one was cool. Presque Isle, obviously. Of course, you can't not mention the St. Augustine Lighthouse. Oh,
gorgeous place. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And that's a lot of steps.
Woo, we went up two stories. My sister and I made it two stories, and we both went, this is enough. And
that's
the ghost.
That's about what Tracy made was about two. And I made it all the way to the top. I don't think I could do it today. And it was hot. It was in August.
Wow. I did the Ghost Hunter picture straight up the center. You know how they had it on their show? But yeah. But that's 14 stories, Jerry. That's a lot.
I didn't remember. I think it was 200 and some steps or something. I couldn't remember what it was.
Whole area is cool. Like how they're making the hand-hewn boats and everything there too. I mean, it's a nice day.
It's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I saw a lighthouse up in Lake Erie, right on. There's a little island on Erie, right off Erie, Pennsylvania, where they have a lighthouse. I saw that one. So, I haven't seen too many of them.
Yeah, there's one at the Thumb of Michigan. Actually, we toured it last summer, and then one a little farther down. And there's a rocky shoal just under the water. through at the tip of the thumb that has taken a lot of boats, a lot of ships. And so the two lighthouses actually work in tandem so that it keeps the ships out of that area. So I have stories on those too. Those are quite storied locations as well. So yeah, nice. I love them, and they're beautiful. They're very tall.
Well, Sarah, you love cemeteries. I think that's an understatement. You've been by our house a couple of times. Once I got to take you to a horse cemetery.
Yes.
That's right by our house. And I could not believe when I told you about it, you were like, oh, I know that place. I'm like, nobody, people here don't even know about that place, but you knew about it. Yeah. And it was really cool to be able to take you back there and see it in person for the first time. Hear all your stories. You're one of the few people that's actually been to our studio and recorded in our studio.
Mm-hmm.
So you got a chance to meet Ninja before Ninja passed away.
Twice I met Ninja, and I met the ferrets and Frappy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You got to meet them all. You just haven't met Lily yet, but that'll be a short time coming.
Yes.
With that being said, mm-hmm. you have helped us tremendously set up this show in Detroit that we're doing. For our 7th anniversary show, you actually scouted out the locations and helped us choose one. Very happy with everything that's went on, and I'm excited to be able to partner up with you on this event. So yes. you've been a lifesaver as far as the running around that you've done for us up there and getting everything set up. So we appreciate that tremendously.
It was my honor. It was so much fun, and I can't wait to get you guys up here and show you my neck of the woods a little bit. And it's going to be a fun time. Do we want to talk about the place?
Let's do it.
All right. It's a VFW hall in Shelby Township. So it's about, as the crow flies, about 40 miles north of the city of Detroit, 30 to 40 miles, somewhere in there. And it's a quaint little town that's growing, and you'll see that there's some construction in the area. They're building some nice condos and things. But the venue itself is just redone, got great parking, pretty easy to find. They're going to provide, for anybody that wants to purchase, hot dogs, hamburgers, and French fries. I think that's what they've got. And then on the show side, we'll provide an open bar of pop, water, obviously, coffee and tea. So it'll be just a fun event, and we'll have a lot of good time. We have something major to celebrate, which is you and Tracy doing this the show for 7 years. And we'll have the guys from Ohio coming out, and Justin Rimmel as well. So it should be a great show. I can't wait. And they have a bar outside of the hall, and I don't think there would be a problem with anybody going out to the hall in purchasing from their bar.
That's typically the way it works at the VFWs. They don't have somebody coming around on the inside like a server, but they will be able to purchase alcohol inside the actual VFW. Okay. I've never seen a VFW where they couldn't purchase alcohol for an event.
Well, it's a good fundraiser for them too. So, and it helps them out. Yeah. And the guys, every time I go up there, they're excited. They can't wait to come and see the show too and see what it's all about. So yeah, I've talked to you guys up a lot.
And the thing about the VFWs and the American Legions and stuff like that, their liquor is cheap.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's usually like the cheap. You can't buy it that cheap at a bar. It's always cheaper at a VFW post. So when we just did our event in Buffalo, I had people saying, I can't believe this beer was only like $2, which I don't know what their prices are there. But for the most part, in everyone we've ever done, the liquor has been pretty cheap. So people tend to like that.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, definitely. Yeah. It'll be a nice show. And like I said, they're excited to have us. It's a nice big room, plenty of room for everybody to spread out and enjoy. And it should be a fun night. It goes from 6 to 10. Yeah. Is that true? Yeah.
Yes. And I've actually worked up anybody who's been to one of our live shows before, of course, we're using the projector and everything now. And I usually try to put a little something in there for each city we did, but we've done some extra special stuff since it is our birthday show. So it's going to be, a blast. Of course, like I said, Nick and Rob from Ohio will be there. And Justin Rimmel from Mysterious Circumstances, you'll be there emceeing the event.
Yes, I'm excited about that. I am. And make sure you bring some money, because there's going to be lots of merch available from what I hear. Yes. Are you bringing any of your foods?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll have everything. We'll have all the food products and the t-shirts and sunglasses, books, You name it, we'll have it. We're excited about it. So we're going to overload and bring a whole bunch of different stuff up there. Also, there might be, like, I don't know, maybe some free cake or cupcakes or something. I mean, it's a birthday, right? You got to have something. So I'm working on exactly what we want to do, but yeah, it's just going to be fun. This, if you, yes, if you only get a chance to attend one event this year, this is the one to attend, because it's, the birthday shows are always the most fun.
Yeah. I think we're going to have a blast. I know we're going to have a blast, and you can't get better with the three podcasts are going to be represented, and I'm excited for that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so. Anytime we do a birthday show, I typically try to have those two podcasts, because our very first live show ever was with those two podcasts.
Really?
It's hard to believe that was, you know, over 5 years ago when we started doing these live events. And you know, so they're a blast. We love hanging out with those guys. It's you know, it's always a fun event when we all three get together. It's no holds barred.
That's good. Entertainment's always fun, right?
Yeah, and Sarah, you mentioned earlier that there's a huge car show or something going on that weekend also, right?
Yes, I was talking with a friend yesterday, and she's like, you know, that's the Woodward Cruise. And the Woodward Cruise is, it runs down a good section of Woodward. I believe it starts at 8 Mile in Woodward and goes all the way up to West Bloomfield. So it's, I don't know, maybe 8-9 miles of just solid cars and solid people watching. It is one of the largest car shows, I believe. I know in the Midwest, but I believe in the U.S. And they just drive up and down Woodward with old cars and new cars that are fancy, you name it. And like all the parking lots are filled with cars with their hoods up, so you can check out engines and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So if you are coming from the west side, coming towards Shelby, I would do everything in your power to avoid Woodward. I was telling Jerry last year, I was in Ferndale, so that's 9 Mile. I had to cross 9 Mile in Woodward, and it took me 25 minutes. So yeah, just avoid that area if you can. And if you want to have great people watching and even better car watching, and you got the time this weekend, head on out there and have some fun.
Yeah. So if you're coming up for the show and you've got the extra time, go ahead and check that out too, because I'm sure that'll be a fun event. Sarah, you can explain this to me, because mm-hmm. for those of us not in the area, mm-hmm. we hear stuff like 8 Mile, 9 Mile. Of course, Eminem made 8 Mile famous. So what exactly, when you guys say 8 Mile, 9 Mile, I've seen 12 Mile, what mm-hmm. exactly is that in reference to?
The city of Detroit is like a wagon wheel. And then beyond that, going up the East Coast, it's more like a grid. So you've got your main roads like Jefferson, Mack, you know, and things like that, that run north and south. And then the East and West streets are your mile roads. So every mile, there's another mile road. And gotcha. So there is 6 Mile in Detroit. I think it even gets down to, you know, 1 Mile, but they don't really call it that. And then it goes all the way up to 40 Mile Road, way north past Shelby. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so Shelby cool. Township is around right around 25 Mile Road.
Okay. Now, I tasked you with trying to sign Eminem up for this event. We were able to do that.
Tried but couldn't. I'm sorry. I would like that. So, well, that'd be pretty cool.
Everybody blames Sarah. She couldn't get Eminem. So I'm not even going to ask about Bob Seger. I'm sure that was a no.
Oh, God. That'd be another one. But let me tell you, there's a restaurant in St. Clair Shores, the city I live in, and they serve amazing burgers. It's called Gilbert's, and Eminem worked there for quite a few years in the kitchen.
Oh, well, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a little history there. See? But yeah, 8 Mile is interesting. It's kind of the dividing line between, yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of dance clubs, I should say, down that strip. So yeah,
dance clubs like adult women dance club, yes, type things. Okay, yes. Okay.
Yeah, that was I had to drive down that one day because the freeway was shut, and my daughters were counting them as they were driving down the freeway.
Trust me, there's a street called 7th Street in Louisville that's a lot like that. So the area around there is actually it's the city of Shively. It's still part of Louisville, but city of Shively, and its nickname is Lively Shively for a reason. So
There you go. And don't get me wrong, parts of 8 Mile are gorgeous, and it's just a small drag that has that the those type of establishments. But yeah, the city of Detroit is gorgeous. They've done so much to it. We have had some really good police chiefs in the city.
Well, let's talk about that. So I've been honest on the show, and I've been honest with you that when if you don't live, and you are the biggest proponent I've ever seen for Detroit, you sing the praises like nobody I've ever met before. You know, I told you when we first put the show on, ticket sales were a little bit slow, and then we made sure people knew, hey, we're not in downtown Detroit. You know, we're actually in a suburb. And when we said that, I think people felt a little safer and ticket sales started going tremendously better than what they had been. But I told you that the stigma of Detroit outside of that area to people like in Kentucky, where I'm at, and other places, Detroit's always kind of had that quote unquote stigma of, you know, not being a safe place. That's what you see on the news. That's what you see, you know, burned out buildings and a lot of you know, closed down places and stuff like that. But you're telling me that that's really not the experience up there. That's kind of what everybody sees on the outside looking in, but that's really not the Detroit that you know.
Well, no, and the news actually, sells more tickets, more sales, more watches if they
Sure.
sell bad stuff. So that's typically what they're going to gravitate to. And yes, there are areas in the city of Detroit, because Detroit's huge, that are not very safe. But
That's
the city,
everywhere.
yeah, the city itself. I mean, I just went down. There was a international soccer game at the Detroit Tiger Stadium, which is Comerica Park. Is down in Detroit as you can get. And my friend and I took, three of, her daughter and my two daughters down there to watch the game by ourselves. I mean, it's beautiful. I've gone to games by myself down there for Tiger Stadium. In the city itself, it's beautiful, especially going down the Woodward Strip down to Jefferson area. And then there's even a boardwalk that goes along the Detroit River. It is gorgeous. And then the jewel of the city, I have to say, is Belle Isle, which, oh, the stories that come out of there. Anyway, Belle Isle is an island that's right off the city. It's just gorgeous. I go there all the time by myself and walk the island. And then there's even great boroughs within the city of Detroit, places that are these gorgeous old homes that actually at one time, many of them had secret passageways between them during the bootlegging days, which there's a lot of stories about that around here. It's not bad. And there's a lot of, like I said, there are a lot of sketchy areas where I wouldn't go without some kind of protection, but definitely the main city itself is beautiful. It's amazing.
And we're the area where we're going to for the show is no issues at all for the most part.
No, I mean it's north. It's Shelby Township is always known for, just being quiet. And there's a beautiful park I hike in all the time. I was just there yesterday. It's actually south of it. It's a huge, I don't even know how many acre park it is, but yeah.
Awesome. Well, we can't wait to be up there. We're only a couple weeks away, so
I
we're
know.
excited.
It's so much fun. I cannot wait to see you guys and again. And I have you guys on my neck of the woods.
Nice. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on. Now, next time we have you on, it'll be more we'll just do the stories and we won't
Yeah.
babble as much about the shows and all that stuff. But I thought it was important on this first episode for people to get to know you.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to this. And I like if people like certain things that they want me to go into more maritime stuff or what have you. We have a lot of sunken ships around us, so those come with stories. And just let me know what you want to hear, and I'll be happy to drum some stuff up for you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sarah. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, guys, that wraps it up for us. Please remember if you want to go to the Detroit show, there's probably going to be cupcakes. And I don't can't think of another reason to go. But if you want to go, hillbillyhorrorstories.com, you can get your tickets right there.
Sounds good. Hope to see you guys.